about the Building 7.
The 9/11 Commission report implicitly admitted that it could not explain the collapse of this building by not even mentioning it.
And as for the jet fuel making a fire, it was a matchstick, not a funeral pyre. It never would have melted that steel, but we don't think as good as we feel. So three buildings fell at free fall speed, due to the PNAC's power lost and greed. Saying, remember the 9/11, just forget about the Building 7.
Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts.
All right, good morning. I have with me on the telephone Dr. Nick Begich, and so if we have any questions, perhaps we can take them towards the end of the show. If you want to reach the studio, the number here is 859-5200. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. It's good to be with you this morning.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being with us. First, I'd like to ask where you're from and what you're a doctor of.
Yes, I'm from Alaska. I live here in Anchorage, and I have a doctorate in traditional and complementary medicines. My area of interest was always electrophysiology, which is where I spend a lot of my time in terms of research. I have not practiced. I strictly research and write and report on issues of technology, and that's what I've been doing about the last 12 years.
Very interesting. So I hear that you've written a book, Angels Don't Play This Harp. And so
right.
For those listeners who don't know, could you explain to us HARP, what it is and the acronym and where it is? And
sure. HARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. It's based here in Alaska, and it is a what it really represents originally was an Air Force and Navy project that was designed to look at ways to develop new weapons technologies that utilize the magnetic field lines of the Earth and the ionosphere, an area above the Earth's surface, that's actually manipulated by the instrument on the ground. And the instrument on the ground is a very large array or field of antennas. And these antennas broadcast radio frequency energy. 180 antennas are in the array or in this antenna field. And what they do is they focus or concentrate radio frequency energy. Almost by analogy, it would be similar to what a laser does with light. You know, if you take a flashlight and you shine it on a wall some distance from you, you see that the light spreads out very rapidly with distance. The same is true with radio frequency energy. But if you can concentrate it or focus it in the same way or a similar way to the way you can focus or concentrate laser light, you can get a much more concentrated level of power. So with HARP, by firing or igniting each antenna in a very specific way, you can get a firing pattern that focuses that radio frequency energy, which gives you the ability then to manipulate these various aspects of our environment. One of the principal, you know, concerns about HARP over the years has been its ability to really interact with environmental factors and perhaps even have a significant impact on them.
So is it known what the HARP antennas were originally designed for?
Oh, sure. Originally, there were several ideas. One is the ionosphere. This layer, beginning about 30 miles above the Earth's surface, is a heavily energized layer of our environment. And what happens is it actually screens out and filters a number of particle streams from space that would make life very difficult here, in fact, impossible if it wasn't for the ionosphere. But what they were looking for is a couple of things. Firstly, back in the early days of radio, the ionosphere was observed in terms of its interaction with shortwave. It allowed shortwave broadcasts to literally bounce off of the ionosphere and bounce around the curvature of the Earth. And whenever we would get solar activity, it would disturb the ionosphere and interfere with global communications of all kinds. And so looking at ways to perhaps stabilize The ionosphere was part of the program initially in terms of communications applications or communications uses. The next thing that came up was they discovered that by pumping energy in or pulsing energy into the ionosphere, the ionosphere begins to respond sympathetically. It actually mirrors the pulse rate. It acts as really mirroring it in the sense of sending back then a signal back to the Earth that can be used for a couple of things. One is it can create extremely long wavelengths or ELF signals, extremely low frequency signals. And these signals are the type that are used to penetrate the Earth and sea, and it takes a long wavelength to penetrate the Earth and sea for communication, for instance, with submarines, another aspect of the project. And then another sort of twist on that same use is when you send these extremely low-frequency signals into the Earth, they penetrate very deeply, and a certain amount of the energy is reflected back. And that energy that is reflected back can be analyzed for what's called Earth-penetrating tomography, which in plain language would be, the analogy would be, it would be like X-raying the Earth or looking into the Earth several kilometers deep.
Wow.
Those uses were major uses back in the 90s when they were first looking at this project, but many other things have developed, of course, since.
So that's like almost like a sonogram?
Yeah, you could equate it to that. I mean, it's the same idea. You're imaging the Earth, and you know, they tested this up in the Fairbanks area of Alaska. They tested it to determine how accurate this was, and it was actually insisted upon by the Congress back in 1995. They said, if you can't prove that this particular application works, then we're not going to continue to fund the project. Well, that year it was funded under non-proliferation and counterproliferation of nuclear weapons, and then when they actually tested it, it was 99% accurate in its ground-penetrating tomography applications. And the next time that came up was right after 9/11 on an MSNBC news report, November 27th of 2001. There was discussion about using HARP for imaging underground tunnels and networks in Afghanistan for locating Osama bin Laden as an example.
Wow. How large is this antenna array?
Well, it's 180 in the field, and these are about 72 feet tall. So they're, and then they have what's called a cross dipole running just the opposite direction. So these are pretty good sized field. I mean, when you think about a field of antennas, there's probably not very many like this anywhere in the world, and there's nothing like this in terms of its flexibility and capability, which is one of the reasons this system has gotten so much attention from the military.
Would this be something that's referred to as an ionospheric heater?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the that's what they called them when they were first coming out. And when they first developed these back, earlier versions of these were developed in the former Soviet Union. They were referred to as ionospheric heaters because in certain modes of operation, they could literally heat the ionosphere up. And if you were to look above the field of antennas, they could affect an area about 30 miles in diameter, and then by utilizing the radio frequency energy, literally heat up that area and cause it to lift or push out into space, perhaps as far as another 200 miles out. Now, what's interesting about that, when you push the ionosphere out like that, then the lower atmosphere moves in to fill that void. And what happens when that occurs is when it changes localized pressure systems, can alter the flow of jet streams, and, of course, the idea of atmosphere being where it shouldn't be, one of the things that came up in this particular use was two things. One, by our side of the equation, the U.S. suggested that this could be used as an anti-satellite technology, because if you can push atmosphere out into the path of a satellite, what happens then is it's traveling at such a high velocity, it hits that atmosphere, creates friction, and then burns up. So it takes them out. And the other place it showed up was really interesting. It was from Russian research that goes way back, and it was released by the Strategic Studies Institute in London. And what they suggested we could do is if you could project trajectory, the incoming direction of, say, an incoming asteroid or comet, you could, most people know that these come in, almost every day something's coming into our atmosphere, but usually these objects burn up before they ever hit the ground. Mm-hmm. And you've got, you know, about 30 miles to accomplish that burn-up. Now imagine a larger object coming in, but if you could push that atmosphere out, and instead of getting 30 miles of friction from the atmosphere, maybe you would get 200 miles of friction from atmosphere. In other words, being able to break up much larger objects coming in at a distance. And that's, you know, those are pretty wild ideas, but, you know, the science bears them out, both the Russian research and the U.S. research in those particular uses.
Mm-hmm. This is something that's being funded by the Department of Defense?
Yes, originally it was Air Force, Navy, and then it went over to DARPA back in 2003. And DARPA is the group that does, it's the Defense Advanced Research Group. And what they're essentially involved with is the science that has multi-agency use and is mainly, they work in the classified areas in terms of developing these types of sciences. And, you know, HAARP originally was supposed to be just a small developmental prototype that was a university project. And, of course, when the project started to get a lot of attention, then it shifted more and more towards the military eventually with DARPA taking control, which is a significant change in the operation of the facility.
Mm-hmm. So originally, when it was part of the university project, Was there intended goal the same?
You know, a lot of it was. You know, the ionosphere, of course, as I said, is really a major area of interest because of its impact on communications. Because when solar activity occurs, all of the things that can interfere with communication. The idea was that hey, maybe we could figure out a way to control it, so that when it went through these erratic periods, we could literally control the environment in a very direct and specific way. And so that, you know, that was kind of the interest area. But in terms of academic research, the study of the ionosphere goes back, you know, many decades and has always been of great interest in Alaska. The Geophysical Institute, which studies these kinds of things, is not very well known. But we have a nationally funded rocket range here in Alaska. It's been funded for hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. We have the HAARP facility and a number of other facilities for looking at things like climate change and just looking at the geophysics of the planet, the underlying things that make this planet work. And you know what's being discovered is phenomenal. But when you take a look at there's a new initiative really in the military, and what they're talking about is full spectrum control. And that means everything. That's electromagnetic in nature. And in order to gain that control, you first have to, of course, understand many of the aspects, and then being able to manipulate those for specific weapons applications or to deny your adversaries the use of their weapon systems. And some examples of that would be if you could disturb, and they believe we can now, disturb the ionosphere in such a way that everybody else's communications are knocked out, except for the operator. The operator, because they know the signals being broadcast to create the disturbance, can also broadcast signals within that environment that would actually make it through. In other words, think about that from a military perspective. You could shut down everybody on the other side's communication to keep yours going. Mm-hmm. You can obviously see the advantage of that. And that was one of the main initial thrusts of this project. And then several other things came out of it. I mean, when Dr. Eastland invented this technology, he had a lot of really interesting ideas. Some were looked at by the military, others were totally ignored. The military looked at the communications, they looked at the earth-penetrating tomography, they looked at the idea that if you could, and there were actually three patents surrounding this idea, and three ideas within the patent, and it was the idea of going over the horizon radar, which was a big deal. Just at the end of the Cold War, we were developing some really interesting new systems so that you could look around the curvature of the Earth and look for incoming objects. Well, when they developed HAARP, what they found out is that they could do much better than that. They could not only get the image, going around the curvature of the Earth, they could also get very low incoming objects like cruise missiles. Could be picked out, for instance, something that wasn't possible with the old over-the-horizon technology, as well as intercontinental ballistic missiles coming back and re-entering from space. So from very low altitudes to very high altitudes, they could actually detect and track incoming objects. And you know, this became interesting from obviously from a military perspective. And then they found out that if they increase the energy to some degree, and then using gamma-ray detectors on space-based satellites, they could actually observe those incoming objects and observe the energy signature, the unique signature around them in the case of those that carry nuclear payloads. This is very important because whenever any scenarios have been painted about, an attack on the U.S. during the Cold War, it was always figured that there would be as many as 100,000 incoming missiles, of which only a few would carry nuclear payloads, and the problem was we couldn't figure out how to sort out the targets.
Uh-huh.
Well, this provides a way to do that, which is extremely important. And then by increasing the power even higher, you could create what's called an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, sufficient enough to knock out the avionics, the things that control the incoming craft, to be able to knock it out of the sky.
So an EMP, would that be similar to what Tesla would call his death ray or particle beam weapon technology?
No, could have very well been the same thing. Nikola Tesla had been talking about that back in the 40s and even before. And, you know, he passed away in the early 40s, but it was one of his suggestions that this technology, a technology could be developed that would literally melt the engines of incoming aircraft. Now, this probably wouldn't be quite that powerful, but what it could do is it would disrupt, for instance, the computers that drive the avionics on those craft, or it would affect the microcircuits within those computers and actually cause them to malfunction. And that's the idea, was if you could sort of overrun the control system, then you could cause the craft to crash and not reach its target. You know, that's a pretty powerful, you know, technology when you consider it on that scale, because everything within the area would be knocked out of the sky. It's much different than smaller EMP weapons that have been developed that can be, that can target, say, an automobile or a piece of equipment on a much smaller scale.
Uh-huh. And then when they look at these images, what type of imagery are they getting? Does it look, you know, like a photograph, or is it much less quality?
You mean in terms of penetrating the Earth?
No.
Those kinds of images?
In terms of the imagery when they're looking, doing the over-the-horizon.
Over-the-horizon, it's not like photography. It's more, it would be equated more like radar. You know, you're looking for those incoming objects, and then because every object, really, you can identify fairly readily, you know, utilizing these systems. But those that carry unique materials, plutonium, for instance, being able to sort out that has always been the challenge. And seeing an opportunity from the military perspective of overcoming that challenge, you know, it's one of the big complaints have been over the missile defense systems has been, well, you know, we can't even figure out which targets to isolate. So that sort of answers that question. And, of course, recently, in the last couple of years, the Soviets have told us about new missiles that actually can change direction in flight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that changes everything in terms of, you know, the ideas being kicked around. And actually, billions of dollars being spent right now on our missile defense system here in Alaska are predicated on the idea that these craft, once launched, once these missiles are launched, they cannot change their flight path. Well, you know, when you build a system designed around that concept, only to find out the Soviets have got a new one, or the Russians now have a new one, where they can literally change direction mid-flight, it makes the system, the missile defense system, obsolete, almost right now. I mean, in the sense of before we've even completed it. So that's pretty amazing, I mean, when you think about technology. But there's other things that have started to come out which we think are more likely going to be the defense side of the equation in terms of how you knock something out of the sky. But in terms of observation, HAARP and the research developed by HAARP has led to innovation that allows us higher degrees and better quality imagery and detection technology so that we can track these objects and eventually knock them out. That direction, I think, we're going to see accelerate. We've seen a couple of U.S. patents, one owned by the Department of Energy for weapons that are based more on spectrum utilization, using in either space-based lasers, which travel much faster than a missile intercepting a missile. I mean, the fastest you can go, I mean, if you were at the optimum speeds with a missile to intercept another one, would be about 30,000 miles an hour, which is certainly a fast speed. That's on reentry speeds, you know, trying to knock something out of the sky. Mm-hmm. But the odds of literally hitting a bullet with a bullet are pretty slim. In fact, in all of the tests that have been done, many have failed. Many of the lead scientists believe those that have been successful have been really staged, set up in a way where they couldn't fail. The newer technologies using lasers travel at 186,300 miles per second, the speed of light. And so when you start to think about that, that's going around the Earth seven times in less than a second. That's the kind of technology most likely that will be used in the future to intercept incoming objects. It'll either be space-based lasers, particle beams, something utilizing energy as its route rather than the old conventional ground-to-air missile.
Mm-hmm. How accurate are the sensors of the gamma radiation? And some things like potassium read in a similar way to uranium? Not that there would be bananas in the pocket.
You know, they were developed specifically for detecting nuclear payloads. And so, you know, from what we've seen, and a lot of the research isn't out there, the patents are, and the patents say that it works. And it was developed by, actually, that particular patent, interestingly enough, was developed by an Israeli group that was associated with the Heart Planners. It's in the cluster of patents owned by the original company as one of those key technologies, because being able to detect with some degree of certainty that payload has been and is a major concern of ours as well as other militaries around the world. And so, you know, from what we can deduce from the patent record, looks pretty solid. I'm speaking with Dr. Eastland about the overall technology. It appears to be very, very solid.
Mm-hmm. How many other countries have ionospheric heaters?
This is, you know, more dispersed than people would recognize. I mean, we first looked into this. It was relatively limited. It was northern European countries. Of course, the former Soviet Union, now Russia, has five of these transmitters, the older transmitters. Tromso, Norway, is the location of another. Arecibo, Puerto Rico. They've built several across Canada now. That Rosalie Bertel, she's a physicist and an MD, very well known in these circles, has been reporting on. And then, of course, the latest one, the most interesting, is the Chinese have announced their own phased array, and that they've located it on their base in the Antarctic, because they need to be close to where the magnetic field lines intersect the Earth. For many of the applications, and the Chinese have established one. And in fact, Dr. Eastland even mentions it in some of his writings now, because this is a significant change. You know, the Chinese demonstrated just a few weeks ago that their capability of knocking out a satellite, and many will remember the controversy that was centered on that. And part of this is it is a race to space to create platforms for weapon systems. The Chinese were giving the signal to the United States that go ahead and do it, but if it's a threat to us, we have the capability of taking it out. Now to see the Chinese moving in this direction, I think is an important observation, and one that likely will accelerate this program even further.
Is the Chinese array actually in Antarctica?
Yes.
Okay.
And they have their own station in the Antarctic. It's much smaller than what we have here. But again, it's a first step for their research. You know, these things don't happen in a vacuum. You know, the countries around the world, when they engage in certain activities, there's usually a pretty good reason for it, at least from their perspective or perception. In the case of China, you know, many think that everything is rosy and wonderful now because they appear to be functioning in a more capitalistic way. Nothing has really changed there. In fact, they're using our system against ourselves. This is a traditional approach in terms of long-term planning in China, and has been. It goes back to, you know, some of the original and some of the finest text on war fighting was developed by a guy named Sun Tzu, wrote The Art of War over 3,000 years ago. this is taught in every major military academy in the world, and the Chinese use this philosophy. Originally, when Mao took China from the Nationalists, he was overwhelmed by the size of the Nationalists, but was able to take over. And this sort of philosophy says, you know, you use systems and you use systems to build up your own, and at some point you able to realize your ideology. So nothing's really changed in terms of China and the U.S. Differences. The only thing that's changed is we have assisted them in building the most incredible manufacturing country ever seen on the planet in the most rapid way that dwarfs what happened in the Industrial Revolution of 100 years ago.
Incredible. Something I wanted to ask you about also is I saw that there was a bill introduced by Dennis Kucinich that would put a ban on psychotronic devices, chemtrails, and other things. And then, from what I read, this bill was removed, and the wording that was reintroduced was exotic weaponry. Is there a lot of exotic weaponry being designed right now, and psychotronic weaponry?
Yes, you know, I think this is true, and I think one of the reasons that the bill was pulled back and the wording changed is because when you get that specific, especially in some of these areas, there's a lot of misinformation out there that we've seen over the years, and I'm sure what Kucinich found was some pretty strong criticism about some of those specific things. When he pulled it back and it was rewritten, that fits the military's own frame. You know, they refer to their own weapon systems in these areas as exotic. Psychotronic weapons have been developed over about five decades to get to where we are today. Now, these technologies we cover in a lot of our material over the years. In fact, we've put together, I've authored and co-authored four books related to the impact of technologies. The one we're talking about today was our very first. The latest one that we published deals in this area of psychotronics, the effect on the human brain. And what we found in the research is tremendous amount of material, even active RFPs right now, requests for proposals by our military, looking for new technologies that could interfere or override mental function, brain performance, in a way that would allow us to modify behavior of adversaries. Now, this is a pretty bizarre area of science, but when you look at it and you look at the volume of research now, uh-huh, it's pretty phenomenal. I mean, in the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, we had, I think, 350 references, more or less. In this latest work, we have an additional 300 references on just the subject of manipulation or controlling human consciousness or the mind.
Oh, what's your new book called?
It's called Controlling the Human Mind, and it's been out since August, and it's actually already in its second printing, and it'll be coming out in German and French later this year. It's gotten a lot of notoriety very, very rapidly. Because it is probably, from two physicists who have reviewed it that are specialists in the area, they said it's the best compilation, the best collection of materials written in a way that most people can understand. It's not written for the scientists, written for the average person, but it has all of those footnotes that take the scientist or the more technically oriented directly into the documents that led us to our conclusions.
I just want to remind the listeners, we're listening to WHCL 88.7 FM. This is Dr. Nick Begich who's speaking with me. My name is Pete Bianco, and we've got another guest. Could you open the door, please? And another thing I want to ask you is, since we are electromagnetic beings, how are these frequencies that are being pumped out by HARP affecting people's bodies?
This is a very good question, because you're exactly right. You know, one of the concerns is that these systems will, in fact, impact our health. And the reason for that is, for instance, the earth-penetrating tomography, this idea of looking into the earth using an ELF signal, to do this, you need a signal between 1 and 20 hertz, or pulses per second, or vibrations per second, cycles per second, however you want to look at that.
Right.
You're talking about, when I use the word hertz, that's what we're talking about. So between 1 and 20, what's interesting is those frequencies correlate to the predominant activity within the human brain. And you can break the human brain predominant activity into a few ranges in terms of frequency, again, in hertz. the lowest level, the deepest states of sleep, 1 to 4 hertz, is the deepest state of sleep. The next state is theta, which is between awake and asleep, or where 3 to 6-year-olds spend a lot of their time. It's where you and I are if we're kind of awake but not yet awake, where we're consciously aware of our dreams. It's the theta state. Mm-hmm. The next state, alpha, which is a more focused, concentrated state, or as athletes or artists will say, it's when you're in the zone. It's when you're in that ideal state for learning and assimilating information. And that runs from about 8 to 12 hertz, and then going from 12 up, you run into the beta ranges, and then above that, gamma ranges. And these become higher agitated states, or more awake or alert states as you go higher up. And what they found is that external signals that oscillate in this same range as the brain will lock on to that external signal and begin to mirror it, begin to follow it. It's called the frequency following response. And this response is the root of many of the psychotronic weapons, because once the brain locks onto that external signal, once the brain begins to mirror it, chemical changes occur in the brain, which then alter your consciousness in terms of your emotional state, or even more more draconian approaches. But this is something that goes back many, many decades now. The original work was done at Yale University by Jose Delgado back in the 60s, and mapping the brain using implants and different technologies that were available then. By the mid-80s, he found out that he could do the same thing with no implantable technology whatsoever, just using a signal, a radio frequency signal, at 1/50th of the energy concentration as the Earth naturally produces. This is a very, very small amount of radio frequency energy. Comparing that to what's around us that man's created, around each of us today is probably more on the order of 200 million times more radio frequency energy than what the Earth produces. But with a fraction of that, 1/10 billionth of that energy that surrounds us, the body could pick out that radio frequency signal, and it would change the emotional states of primates and humans, like flipping on and off a light switch from lethargic and passive to highly aggressive. And this was done with very little radio frequency energy in terms of concentration, and it was done in 1985. And here we are now, two decades later, with a system that's capable of generating exactly the same kind of signals, either as an intentional effect or as a side effect when it's operating in these other modes of operation. So it's this is something that certainly has changed the dimension of war fighting. The idea of large-scale psychotronic weapons actually goes back even further. It goes back to some ideas of J.F. Gordon MacDonald, who was a geophysicist at UCLA. He wrote a chapter in a book called Unless Peace Comes Back in 1969. In that chapter, he talks about being able to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way to return a signal to the Earth that would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with that signal over huge geographic areas. Now, he was not just the average geophysicist. He was also a science advisor to President Johnson when he was in that position. This is, after that time that he was making these statements. They were then echoed by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who became, in 1976, National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter. But in the early 70s, he was at Columbia University. He had written a book called Between Two Ages, where he talked about the same concept of being able to manipulate the ionosphere in just the right way as to have the effect of manipulating then the behavior of people over huge, huge geographic areas. The same idea then was advanced by Persinger at Laurentian University in Canada, who does a lot of research in the magnetic effects or field effects on the human mind. And what he said is that if we could ever couple with the magnetic field lines of the Earth, we could, in fact, manipulate the behavior of people over huge areas. All of these guys were saying the same thing, but it wasn't until the middle and late 90s that we had an instrument that could actually do this, and that's of course, HARP is capable of doing exactly this.
Mm-hmm. Something that you mentioned that I'm seeing a correlation between is when HARP pulses out a signal, you're saying that the ionosphere mimics it, and when these people are trying to pulse out a signal, then your brain will also mimic it. So is that...
Yeah, exactly right. It's the same idea.
So, I don't know.
Same idea.
Does that infer anything about that, like, the ionosphere is alive and we're alive, or?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily, you can take that conclusion. But what we can say is that, you know, the systems are active. I mean, they're all active. They are not closed systems either. You know, this is the idea that everything kind of runs itself and we just sort of exist separate from everything. And they've determined, you know, over the years, all of the sciences are recognizing increasingly over the years that all of these systems are intimately connected. And when you affect one, you affect the others. And when you're dealing with the ionosphere, you know, our body acclimates to a certain pulse rate. Before we industrialized the planet, the Earth created its own pulse rate, and it was 7.83 hertz. It's referred to as Schumann's resonance. It was discovered back in the early 50s by a gentleman in Munich. And this is literally the pulse rate of the planet. 7.83 hertz correlates to the alpha rhythm within the human brain, the ideal place or that zone where we do the best. And when you consider that, you know, it makes sense. Our bodies acclimated to this planet, and then we brought in 60 cycles or 60 hertz in the U.S., 50 hertz in Europe. These are the, if you look at your electrical apparatuses, they'll say 110 or 120 volts and 60 cycles. Well, the 60 cycles is the 60 hertz, and this is a high level. This is a level of, and you can feel it. I mean, if you think about the next time the power goes out in your area, the first thing you notice is how quiet everything is when all the fan motors aren't running and your computers and your refrigerator stops running. But most people also will note that their whole body almost has an exhale. It's like your whole body just relaxes a bit, almost the same feeling you get when you go out of urban areas into the country. And the reason for this is your body is constantly compensating for these external fields of energy. They're compensating for it in a way that allows your body to more or less function and maintain its equilibrium. When those signals are removed from your immediate environment, you notice them because you're no longer feeling those stressors, or no longer your body's no longer trying to compensate for those stressors. So again, very important observations being made, and yet when we consider these huge systems, there's not much and has not been much public discussion. Now with HARP, of course, that's changed. You know, we've been dealing with the issue for now over a decade. It's you know, been looked at by many around the world, and you know, a number have weighed in against it. The European Parliament, a good case in point, came out against this technology back in 1998, right after we testified. They passed a resolution finally in the early part of 99, and you know, this technology has gotten a lot of attention. Continues to get a lot of attention, but it has not slowed this project down significantly.
So perhaps we shouldn't be looking for more ways to generate energy. Everybody's talking about how are we going to make more energy? How are we going to get more, solar panels and wind turbines and all this to put more electricity around us?
Well, you know, that's true. I mean, when you think about it, you know, and this is, again, something that has been showing up in literature, these low levels of energy were always considered safe. And yet now we're understanding a little bit more about how the brain and body works, the development of technologies that exploit that knowledge for weapons systems development is certainly part of it. But in the course of it, you know, the Soviets, when they were around, you know, they understood the effects, the biological effects of energy. In fact, their guidelines for exposures was 1,000 times more stringent, more strict than the U.S. standards, because they understood these underlying mechanisms that would drive our physical bodies in much different directions. Now, it didn't mean that they, you know, enforced their own regulations, but at least they acknowledged the biological effects. And this is something that there is significant Russian literature on the subject, and a growing body of European and U.S. literature on the subject. In fact, we quote many, many documents that show the evolution of the knowledge, as well as some of the documents that have been declassified or are unclassified by our military. And, you know, this direction of energy-based weapons is really the direction in which our military has been headed for quite some time. They call it a revolution in military affairs, and they compare it to the introduction of atomic weapons in the last century or gunpowder into the Middle East or Middle Ages Europe, back years and years ago. Those changes completely changed warfighting. Energy-based technologies in the 21st century will define warfighting in a much, much different way than in the past. And why it's important is when you're using energy as your base, you're using a system that travels at literally the speed of light. When you get into the space-based lasers and particle beam weapons, these are not like retractable. Once fired, you cannot pull them back. You cannot destroy them in mid-flight. You cannot, stop the energy from reaching its target once discharged. And now think about that in the environment that our government has introduced called preemptive warfare, where we determine who our adversaries are. We don't say anything to anyone. We just go and attack them. Well, when you do that with this type of system, everything changes because you have the ability to devastate an adversary before they even know they are one.
Mm-hmm. I have another
question. And that's the direction.
I have another friend in the studio who's got a question for you.
Sure.
Yeah, hi. I think my headphone's off here. I have a question we were listening on the way up here about the electroshock, how you can do it on a wide field, and you can, make people either be aggressive or non-aggressive. And
yes.
Okay, and then you can send it into a whole wide field. So in other words, you could do it like over a whole town or city or quote-unquote battlefield. Now, is that sort of equivalent to John Edwards, who just passed away the other day? They were talking about how he had to drop out of the vice presidential race because he was getting electroshock for depression. Is that the equivalent of what they're doing with
the brain? That's a much, much, much different situation. I mean, electroshock therapy was used, by psychologists thinking they were doing something good because they found that there were these properties within the brain that could be affected. The problem is, we always try to, do what you can do with a feather with a hammer. That's the wrong approach. And, we always do this. And there's a paper, a very important one. It's called The Mind Has No Firewalls. And it was, it appears at the U.S. Army War College. You can find it online at their site, U.S. Army War College, under their publication called Perimeters. And they published this article about the ways in which you could manipulate human behavior. And it's a translation and amplification of an article originally published in the former Soviet Union. And I'll just read you a quick quote, a one-liner out of it. And it says, a psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This signal would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal, unquote. What it's saying is that you can use, in the case of HARP, you're using the ionosphere itself to carry your signal. In other words, you're using the magnetic fields and the energy system of the Earth, the ionosphere, to carry a signal that would affect then a large population. But on a much smaller scale or more directed scale, what has been found is you can use any electromagnetic carrier, radio waves, TV, internet, anything that can carry an electronic signal, electromagnetic signal rather, you can then piggyback a signal on that will in fact couple with the human mind or body in a way that creates these various effects. And it's something that our science has noted and made plenty of mention of. The Soviets have gone much further, the former Soviet Union, in their research. Now the Russians in their research. There was actually a really good segment that was produced by CBC, the Canadian Public Broadcasting System, on the mind control in the program called Undercurrents back in 1999. And they interviewed some of the folks involved in this research in the Soviet Union. They interviewed me in terms of the U.S. side. And there's also a really excellent report that just came out of Sonoma State University earlier in, this year in January that gets into electromagnetic weapon systems. In fact, we have a copy of that posted on my website, and it's free. I mean, it's there for the taking, as well as some more, much more information on this idea of psychotronic weapons. And some of the early research, we have a number of documents that were produced by the Defense Intelligence Agency that have been released that we have posted on our site that deal with, some of the more really exotic stuff that was going on in the 70s, and then deals with the more modern developments of the 90s and this century. I think we have 13 documents posted there now that are pretty extensive and very useful for people that are interested in, say, the mind control or psychotronic aspects of this issue.
Nick, could you give us your website for the listeners?
Oh, sure. It's sorry about that.
Right.
It's earthpulse.com, EARTHPULSE, earthpulse.com. And that takes you, if you look on the left-hand side when the screen comes up, you'll see a list of selections. One of them is called Mind Control. Click on it, and you'll get to those articles. And they're all free. They're available there. And we have a research site that's kind of interesting. It's the Lay Institute, layinstitute.org. And that site has a search engine with many of our documents posted there. You can go into the EPI search engine under layinstitute.org. And I think we have 700 or 800 documents there now that you can word search, and you won't get the whole document because most of them are copyrighted, but you'll get abstracts and summaries and complete citations so you can look things up later. So those two sites provide a huge amount of information. The earthpulse.com site has hundreds of pages of data that is freely available for people interested in these subjects.
One of the last things you were talking about is a good reason for people to switch over to solar. get all the power lines going to your house that are connected from an outside source cut off, and you could just hook up your own electricity.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of really interesting things coming in the sciences, and I cover technology trends. You know, I do a radio program in the afternoons every day that's on the internet at gcnlive.com, and we talk about technology trends and the direction of these technologies. And, you know, we've covered so much over the years. I mean, the four books I've published, we have over 1,650 reference sources. In my archives, I have over 20,000 documents that I've retained out of probably a couple hundred thousand that I've read. And, you know, consolidating information and then interpreting it in a way that is rational and reasonable and then providing that source material has been sort of our hallmark in this work. You know, technology is complicated. It's advancing very rapidly. There are not very many generalists that can kind of look across the technologies and sort of see how they interact and interreact. I work with a lot of specialists from around the world that are top-flight scientists in their field, and by both learning from them and sharing with them what we're finding, we're able to develop material that is useful for the layperson. I mean, I consider myself not so much a scientist as a translator, you know, trying to take some very complicated ideas and bring them down into relatively plain English so that we could actually have a discussion like we're having today that makes some sense, and that we can kind of knit together what has come out of the research and then consider the implications of that research. I mean, think about technology today. Every powerful country in the world are those that control the highest and best technologies. And so, you know, for those of us within democratic republics like this one, it's very important that the average person at least have some knowledge of what these technologies are about so we can better direct our elected officials to make sure these things are developed within our interest. And, you know, people say, well, you know, technology is just too complicated. Well, if that were true, none of us would be driving cars because they become too complicated for most of us to repair, and yet conceptually, we understand the automobile. You know, we can get in it, we can drive it, get it from place to place. And the same is true with any of our technologies. We don't have to know how to build our computers on our desktops, but we can certainly know something about their implications.
Mm-hmm. We just had a caller call in. Caller, if you could call back, I can take your call now. I didn't want to interrupt in the middle of what you were telling me. And so, Nick, if I take this call and I lose you, because I'm not too savvy at the telephone here, I'll just give you a call back.
Not a problem.
And so if the caller calls back, I'm going to interrupt you in the middle of this question, but I'd like to
know, not a problem.
I'd like to know how much electricity is put into HARP when it's activated.
Well, this is important. You know, the amount of power, there's been a lot of confusion about this because it's the effective rate of power, the effect of the energy that you're more concerned about, and effective rate of power eventually will reach a billion watts. Now, that is not related to the input power. The source of the input power right now is the power grid here in Alaska and private-owned generators on the facility. Eventually, magneto-hydrodynamic generators will be used, which are generators that are relatively compact and can convert natural gas to electricity very efficiently. This is where, why, in fact, the North Slope of Alaska becomes interesting is because of our vast supplies of natural gas that we have there, as well as the location is close to where the magnetic field lines intersect the Earth, and so you can transmit the energy much closer than, say, at the equator, where it's the furthest out. And so, you know, when you start to think about it, you know, where they located was relevant, the amount of energy available in terms of domestic supplies of energy. You know, we have in natural gas on the North Slope of Alaska trillions and trillions of cubic feet. And then in additional methane resources, methane hydrate resources, we have 450 trillion cubic feet of natural gas available. So huge amounts of natural gas in the locations that are needed to generate the kind of power that would be needed for a complete system of these phased arrays for a global effect.
I've got a question about something you were speaking about earlier. If the sensors for the radiation from nuclear payloads is accurate, then why in the news reports do we hear that Homeland Security can't come up with an accurate device when checking cargo?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I have no clue why Homeland Security can't get their act together. I would suggest that perhaps, like government, when you're dealing with the classified side of these projects versus the airports, I couldn't tell you, I mean, why the Homeland Security can't connect up. I mean, it's very different technology. We're talking about a satellite-based technology versus something for an airport, but the principles have to be the same, and I just don't buy that answer. I think there are technologies out there. We see them in the literature. They're within the patent record. There's just the typical bureaucratic disconnect. I mean, the way projects are developed in the U.S., science is compartmentalized and classified. Compartmentalization means that you don't see the whole picture. Everything is separated. There's no integration. And oftentimes, you'll see exactly the same kind of science being done in labs and other facilities because they don't even know the other guy is doing it, you know, within other branches of the service. It's a very cumbersome way of developing science, number one, because you don't get the full benefit of multidisciplinary approaches where you see things a little bit differently. And secondly, you don't have a connection like this, where all of the agencies are fully cognizant of what else is out there that might serve their administrative purposes. And so, you know, compartmentalization, while it's great for national security on one hand, it works against national intelligence in the other by limiting what we know. The way the Soviets, incidentally, kept up with us was by approaching this from exactly the opposite direction. Their belief was that by integrating the sciences, you gain more. And in fact, they never could keep up with us productively in terms of manufacturing and production. But scientifically, they kept up because they used this approach of multidisciplinary teams, which bred more generalists, which produced more integrated science, and science that actually lends itself to this kind of research today, because it is the former Soviet Union from which many of the research papers in this area are now coming out.
Is HARP the same thing that the Reagan administration would speak about as Star Wars, or this is different?
It's a little bit different. I mean, Reagan was thinking of a totally satellite-based or space-based system. When Dole ran for president, he started talking, when he ran against Clinton the first time, he started talking about a land-based system, a system that made this much cheaper and much more efficient. That's about the time that HARP started to come online in terms of government funding and, you know, where those advances were being made. And the reason that that's so much more economical, obviously, is if you can service something on the ground. You can drive a pickup truck to it with a toolbox. So that's not so simple on space-based systems, as well as we're vulnerable in space. And we just saw that demonstrated by China, who is not nearly as advanced as we believe that we are or the former Soviet Union is. And so when you consider all of this and you start to look at the implications, Star Wars never really went away. In fact, Bill Clinton, who originally said he opposed Star Wars, by the end of his administration, in 1 year alone, he had funded Star Wars-related research at a higher level, adjusting for inflation, than Ronald Reagan ever did. And so although Reagan got the notoriety, Clinton, as he went through it up through his administration, he had the higher expenditures in any given year to advance the science, and this administration has continued to advance space-based weapon systems, because ultimately, you know, if you control a space, then you have the ability to target any place on the planet almost instantly. The kinds of technologies that are advancing, and as the technologies merge, computing power, imaging capability, all of these things are advancing so rapidly that the refinement of being able to pick out through the spectrum and being able to look literally through this planet or look at any aspect of this planet by sensors, being able to pick up the unique characteristics of every living and innate organism, everything that's on this planet, and being able to interpret it and visually see it. Think about this for a moment. As we gain the knowledge and we gain the computing power, which is happening very rapidly, everything becomes transparent to the right military platforms, and then that changes the dimension of war fighting forever.
Mm-hmm. When China took down the satellite, they didn't use their HARP technology for it, did they?
No, that was a ground-to-air operation. At least that's the way it was reported. You know, who knows what they actually used. What it did do, though, is excite everyone, because we didn't think the Chinese could do this. And at the same time, you know, everyone talked about, you know, creating space debris and problems, but the Chinese were telling us very clearly, don't mess around with us. You know, we have the capability of disrupting your society much more than you can disrupt ours. And if you consider it, you know, without satellite technology, without when we are in the West so dependent on technology, these are the systems that can literally bring us to our knees. Chinese are not so dependent on the technologies of the West at this point. And so we are the one who are the most vulnerable. The Chinese spend a tremendous amount of money on what's called information warfare, being able to hack through our systems to overrun them. They know that if they can shut down our electromagnetic systems, in other words, they're looking for spectrum dominance as well. The reason Chinese military budgets have been in the news recently and are getting a lot of noise, you know, they increased their budget openly by about $10 billion. Now, in the West, we think of $10 billion. I mean, what does that buy? You know, not too much. But the Chinese expenditures are about 10%. Their annual expenditure is about 10% of what ours is. But you get 10 times more in China for the same money in terms of scientific know-how, manufacturing capability, etc. You buy hammers in the U.S. maybe in the military for $1,500 and a toilet seat for $1,000. In China, if you try that maneuver, you get a bullet in the back of the head, and it goes back to normal. You know, they don't mess around. Money is spent extremely efficiently in comparison to what happens in the U.S. And when it's not in China, the penalties are terminal.
Wow. I'd like to ask you about chemtrails. Is this anything that you've studied?
You know, we've looked a little bit at it, but it's not an area that we're following. There's just too much misinformation that we see in that subject area. It's a lot of bad sampling, so we've just avoided it. Now, there's some things historically that show up that, you know, give some credibility to part of it, but, again, it's not an issue that we're following, primarily because there's just too much, at this point, disinformation about it, and can't do everything. It's just another example of perhaps some a lack of accountability in government.
Mm-hmm. I got some more questions for you, but they're not here yet. What do you got?
Historical examples. Like, what historical examples would you say?
What historical examples?
Examples of?
In
terms of you know, spraying from airplanes, which is what chemtrails is all about, is. Historically, back in the 60s, there was some experimentation being done where they were spreading viral material in some municipalities within the United States using aerial spraying. And the idea was the military was interested in seeing how viruses actually would migrate through a population. And they were considering, you know, if we were attacked by biological agents, you know, how would that happen? So they wanted to do it. And
that's
they did it on U.S. citizens. And this is. Oh, of course. You know, Secretary of Energy O'Leary, when she was there, when Clinton was in, she admitted to 500,000 Americans being used in human experiments without their consent. And this included everything from, injecting Native Alaskans with radioactive iodine to see what would happen over their lifetimes, to blacks in the South being given syphilis to see how they would die over their lifetimes, to these kinds of experiments that took place. So, I mean, the record is there for spraying, so, you know, it's certainly got some history. The other area that comes up is on the contrail side of the equation, which is the exhaust coming out of jet engines that causes a certain amount of moisture to collect where you get these nice trails. Well, contrails were looked at back in the early 80s when Dallas-Fort Worth Airport was expanding rapidly, and they determined and had a theory that perhaps jet traffic was adding to the formation of cumulus clouds that led to more severe storms in the southeastern United States. Well, it was a theory up until 9/11. When 9/11 happened and all the air traffic in the country shut down, they then were able to quantify this theory, rerun the math, and make it into a science fact. The fact is, normal jet air traffic adds to cumulus cloud formation, which increases storm intensity. That's the conclusion of that research, and when you look at it, you think about how much air traffic has increased over the years and the fact that you know, we get increasingly, over these same decades, parallel increases over severe storm activity or the more severe storm activity. So, I mean, all these things, once again, interrelate. How much is man responsible for, how much is natural, is part of the major international debate right now. But one thing is for sure, things are changing, and we're having an impact on those changes, both positively and negatively.
What about HAARP as used as a weapon for manipulating weather, like to cause drought or tornadoes? I mean, are these capabilities of the system?
Yeah, you know, this is something, again, that came out in the early work, the idea of ionospheric heating, as an example, pushing the ionosphere out and then allowing the atmosphere then to fill in or move into that space will change localized pressure systems. You could also use it for diverting jet streams, so in that sense, absolutely. Now, since that time, there's been a couple of other papers produced. Bernard Eastland was hired by the European Space Agency to look at weather modification applications with HAARP, specifically for knocking up the power of tornadoes. And he did this research for the European Space Agency. It was presented in Europe in a peer review environment. It was then after that FEMA and NASA contacted Dr. Eastland, and he prepared a paper on space-based lasers being used for weather modification. He then came up with some new concepts using gravitational and acoustic waves in conjunction with HAARP in a way that would manipulate weather and with energy levels that were 1,600 times less than what he originally thought was needed when he invented HAARP back in the 1980s and early 90s. That's a very important issue because the fact that it's been now recognized that it doesn't take nearly the amount of energy, it changes everything. And the idea of weather modification is something we've actively pursued, as well as other governments, since before Vietnam, I mean, since the 1950s, originally with like things like cloud seeding and those types of things, but now in much more sophisticated ways are we anticipating being able to do the same thing.
What is the Department of Defense's explanation for what they're doing in Alaska?
They say it's a developmental prototype, purely academic, and I can assure you the military does not just engage in academic research for the sake of academic research. They only engage in research for specific weapons applications. Now, their own literature, which we quote extensively from, lays clear that this was a developmental prototype to test all of these weapons applications. The original contract documents bear that out. As well as all of the research that has come out since. What has been released to the public clearly shows that this is a developmental prototype indeed for the development of new and more advanced exotic weapons technologies.
Have you heard anything of the theory of global dimming, where there's more and more cloud cover and less sun reaching the Earth?
Yes. You know, and you know, this is again, you know, I mean, and that creates, you know, all kinds of conditions. You know, the idea of, you know, man contributing to this. This is another important thing that Eastland brought out in one of his patents was two issues. One, particulate pollution and various chemicals that get into our upper atmosphere that add to greenhouse gases and so on. And at the same time, we're seeing things like ozone depletion. What he said is using radio frequency energy, you can literally create chemical reactions in those areas of our environment, in these high layers, and actually trigger chemical reactions that could be used for knocking out specific pollutants, very specific pollutants, or for creating reactions that would then replenish ozone, as an example. Those are not being pursued as uses by our military, and yet, given what we're hearing about climate change, the global dimming effect, and some of these other things, it would seem to me to be perhaps maybe one of the more important areas of research that should be pursued, and one that actually might serve our interest in a constructive way rather than a destructive way.
Mm-hmm. And I think that a reason that people should be so concerned that this is occurring is that you can't manipulate one part of the web of life without affecting the rest of it. So
that's exactly right, and this is exactly the bottom line. None of these things operate in a vacuum. They all interact and interact, and we can all be subjected to significant changes and not even have the visibility of, say, a tree falling in the forest or a bomb going off. These are electromagnetic radiations. They're invisible to any of our senses as human beings, and yet they can override and manipulate the very essence of who we are.
Another thing that I read was that when you're talking about the frequencies of brainwaves, is that television is broadcast at those frequencies also?
Well, television is a little unique. I mean, it's the flicker effect that becomes important. You know, the energy itself isn't so much of a problem. I mean, if you get close to a television and you touch the screen, you can feel the static discharge, and as you get a few inches away, it goes away very, very rapidly. And so the theory has always been, no problem. You know, you sit 10, 12 feet back from a television, everything is safe and wonderful. And then it was back in the middle 90s that an incident occurred in Japan where children were watching a cartoon, and there was a flicker rate. The screen, because of the way in which the image was projected, flickered at a very specific rate, and it essentially created the FFR response, the frequency following response. 700 children went to the hospital with epileptic seizures from that experience when it was considered perfectly safe. And the idea of triggering these kinds of effects in the brain using flickering light, as an example, is something that can be done easily with either computer screens or television screens. The flicker effect has been noted in tremendous amount of literature, and you know, there's no question, within very few seconds, your brain will lock on to that external signal. Here's another example of where that knowledge is being used. It's understood in the area of psychology, the flicker effect. It's also understood because psychology is interrelated with advertising, understood by advertisers. Think about this: when next time you're watching a television commercial in a dark room, look at the wall behind you where you can see the flicker effect.
Yeah, I know.
And in most cases, if you were to look at an EEG, monitor the brain of people watching TV, you'll find that their brain waves slow. They get into this very suggestive state. And advertisers who understand this can actually create a light effect within the commercial within the first 10 to 20 seconds that will put you into a state of accepting the overt advertisement much more readily. Now, it's not illegal. It's not restricted in any way because it's not a subliminal, but it is just as impacting as a subliminal might be. In political advertising, where people on the presidential level now, we're talking billion-dollar campaigns, believe me, this knowledge is known, unregulated, unrestricted, and I believe that if it were analyzed, the commercial messages coming out these days, that this flicker effect would be picked up in much of the more sophisticated advertising that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. So now that we've heard all this, what can we as ordinary people do to protect ourselves from these kind of things?
Well, I think the most important thing is what we've been doing this morning is public education has been our major emphasis, and as a result, you know, people have begun to, you know, inquire of their congressional leadership, you know, what is going on with these technologies. That's what happened with us in Europe. That's how the European parliaments began to take the issue up, and many of them have. Our belief was that it was easier to work within Europe to get this knowledge elevated, only because of the average person's science background is quite frankly a little bit better in European educational systems, and that worked. And then our intention was to put back pressure to the U.S., so that the U.S., again, would take a look at it. Kucinich is the only one that I know of in the Congress that has been willing to take any of these kinds of issues on. And it's unfortunate because these issues are neither left nor right. Mm-hmm. They are dead on center. I mean, these are the issues that are going to affect us now and into the future. I think the best thing that we can do is become educated on the issues and get material to your congressional leadership. You know, there's a lot of articles posted on our website. They're free. There's nothing like taking a handwritten letter and hooking an article to it and sending it to your congressional leadership. It does make a difference. Don't email them because they don't even read those anymore. They're just automatically responded to. Handwritten letters still make a difference. I think political leadership is needed in this area, and hopefully in this decade we'll see some significant changes. Unfortunately, within the Congress, there's very little in terms of scientific background. I mean, the Congress are not congressmen are not scientists. My dad was a member of the 92nd Congress back in the 70s. I had the opportunity to meet, as a young person, dozens and dozens of congressional people. Most of them come out of law and other academic backgrounds, but not science. And this is the area that, in this Democratic Republic, is in fact the most important. And where the most important science is discussed is by military in closed hearings where only congressional leadership is there, and they don't have the basic knowledge to even ask fundamental questions, because to ask a good question, you must have a good base of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Anybody got any last questions before we go?
Just keep up the good work.
Yes, keep
hey, thank
work.
You guys, and we appreciate you covering this very important issue. Take a look at the website, earthpulse.com. A lot of good information there on some of the other issues that we cover. Perhaps we can do this again.
Oh, definitely. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, and we'll talk to you again in the future.
Okay. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Dr. Nick Begich. He's speaking to us from Alaska on the topic of HAARP. Antennas that can be used for a variety of things, including manipulating mental state, weather, and doing some over-the-horizon radar. If you've had any questions about this, or you'd like to comment about what you just heard, criticism, reach me here at the station. The number is 859-4200. Actually, if you want to get onto the air, then it'd be 859-4200. 4561.